Hello, everybody. Good morning and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matt Sainsbury, editor-in-chief of digidownloaded.net. And with me this week, we have two Aussies, so no foreigners, no New Zealanders for a change. We've got Harvard. Hello, Harvard.
Hi, good to be back.
And we have Trent. Hello, Trent.
Hey, I also woke up way too early, like the usual time, so I'm a bit tired now.
Yeah, it's a thing we do on Saturday mornings, this podcast. But, yep, it's good. Should have plenty of fun stuff to talk about this week. So we'll have our usual Hatsune Miku track to start things off. A little bit different this week. It's actually not a track you can play on any of the video games because, yeah, it hasn't appeared on any of them. It's a cover of God is a Girl, which is a great song, and it's a pretty cool cover, actually. So enjoy, and then we'll get back and start chatting. Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that music. Okay, so for the first section of the podcast this week, we're going to talk about Game Awards. It's that time of year where the major, the major Game Awards of the year, the Game Awards, it's a pretty simple title really, is announced, or at least at the moment they've got the shortlists for the various games, categories and potential award winners. And we wanted to talk about that because, for the most part, we think it's a pretty crappy list of shortlists that they've got. And then we'll talk a bit about our own awards because we do have the Digitally Downloaded Awards coming up, and we announce those winners starting in December. So we wanted to give you a bit of a preview of that and talk about, I guess, what we look for when we decide which games are kind of the best of the year, or at least the award winning deserving of the awards each year. So yeah, let's start by having a look at the Game Awards. As per usual, I guess it's safe to say that the nominations are very Western game development focused. and quite heavily orientated towards the big end of town, the stuff that AAA blockbusters developers create. And, you know, we're talking about stuff like Horizon, Wolfenstein, what else? Yeah, all the kind of the usual suspects from the year, I guess, that you kind of assumed would get the nod. Are the ones that kind of got shortlisted. There's a couple of ones that for various categories from Japanese developers as well. Nier Automata got a nod for a few, probably not nearly enough given the quality of that game, but a few. Nintendo had a pretty good showing too with The Legend of Zelda and Super Mario Odyssey getting shortlisted quite a few times. But yeah, for the most part, I'm would question a lot of those awards. I think that the ones that were shortlisted and will probably win are pretty good quality games, but very safe choices in terms of, you know, again, they were kind of expected to be because they were the ones that had the most money thrown at them through the year in development and marketing. So I'm never happy with the shortlist of these awards, and I'm not again this year. But yeah, Harvard, what are your thoughts?
I think that everything here is pretty deserving. I think that the Japanese developers definitely did turn up this year, way much more so than the last couple of years. They've been developing more for a world audience, which I think is really reflected in how we're getting so many nominees. We're getting Zelda, we're getting Super Mario, we're getting Nioh, Persona, Nier. I think is going to see definitely at least one or two Japanese games getting the final award this year. But it is a shame that they're going up against some big talents in the West as well. Especially looking at Game of the Year, it's so hard to figure out which one deserves it, because like you've got something like Breath of the Wild, which is so ambitious. You've got something like PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which has just been such a cultural force. And then you've got something like Persona 5, which has been so visually unique and memorable. And there's so many other things that you could add to the list, but you can't take away anything from the things that they've written here.
Yeah, I'm certainly not suggesting that the games that were nominated were poor quality. Like I said, they're all good games, otherwise they wouldn't be there. But yeah, I always find that with these awards, it goes more on, I guess, the perception of popularity in terms of, you know, this game was big and popular and everybody loved it when it came out, therefore it must get an award, as opposed to, I guess, looking at more intrinsic value of the game.
Yeah, my only gripe is if Horizon wins anything. I'll be sad if Horizon wins anything. It's so funny. I've gone 360 on that game. When it first came out on the sizzle reels for Sony, I was like, this is the only interesting looking game that Sony is going to put out. And then I went full 360, I played the demo, and I was like, oh, it's kind of just the same, and now we're here.
Yeah, we've obviously talked a bit about Horizon in previous podcasts, and I think my thoughts on the game are pretty well known. I don't think it's a bad game by any means, I just don't think it's anything special, other than the fact it is, you know, quite gorgeous, but then other games have come along and done the beautiful thing better this year as well. Like, I'd honestly say that Hellblade is a much better looking game than Horizon, despite, you know, having some basic similarities, I guess, in terms of the visual style. I'm just looking through the awards now, and yeah, there's Persona obviously got nominated for a few, and I should have mentioned that as well. But it's a bit surprising itself because it wasn't all that great as far as Persona games go. So
I think the biggest problem here is a lot of them are nominated quite a lot of times. So you're looking at the list and you're like, oh, there's Persona again. Oh, there's Mario. You know, it's not like they're not deserving of those categories, but there's so many games this year which could be, you know, put into some of the more obscure categories where it's like, okay, well, these games are obviously worthy of, you know, some great awards because they're really good games. Why aren't they in more obscure categories? Like Best Narrative could have had so many more games than what's in this shortlist. You know, the shortlist is basically, as said earlier, very, you know, AAA or very marketing pushed rather than, you know, more obscure or less, you know, interesting games, which would have, you know, not been looked at by many people. So,
I was just going to say, I actually completely agree with you, because 2017 in particular has been a game where a year where there's been like a kind of a endless supply of really high quality games. You know, you haven't really been able to go a week without something great coming out. So to try and narrow that down is obviously difficult, but I think they've kind of focused on a small selection of games, like you said, rather than go for a broader look, which would have been more reflective of what actually happened in 2017. The other one that I really have an issue with is a particular category here, which they call Games for Impact. I really don't know. Category. It seems to be a category where they've shoved the really indie stuff just to, you know, stick these indie games in there. They say it's for a thought-provoking game with a profound pro-social meaning or message. And I think that any game that wins an award in any category should have that as a minimum criteria. What's the point of playing a game if it doesn't have something profound about it? And I think that all the games that are listed in there, like Please Knock on My Door, Night in the Woods, Life is Strange, Bury Me My Love, and Hellblade, you know, these games deserve to be placed against, you know, blockbuster games in other categories and deserve to have a good chance, because what they do is very profound and very potent and very important. Obviously, Hellblade did get a couple of nominations in other categories, but the other ones didn't. And I think that's kind of like the foreign film section at the Academy Awards, where they just kind of get these films that they don't really want to win against the blockbusters and shove them into a corner where they can still say that at least they're awarding them something. And I don't think that's the right way to go.
Well, there's even a section which is mostly, it's called Best Chinese Game, and it's essentially mostly Western games or more obscure, you know, there's a few Chinese games, but you've got Monument Valley there, and it's basically only picked by, you know, viewers in China. Like, it's, you know, it's sort of, there is a foreign section essentially in the Games Awards. Like, it's, yeah, interesting how they've done that.
Yeah, I think that Best Chinese Award, Best Chinese Game Award is a sponsored one. So
yeah, I think Tencent's one of the sponsors.
Yeah. So it's
actually, we all know how big Tencent is now in Chinese gaming.
Yeah, like how you've got the best indie game where it's like presented by Slick Hydro, and there'll probably be like some corny video before them. What's that? That's the one with like the, it's like a robot sort of thing. It's like shaving, isn't it? No? I don't know. There was like lots of ads last time.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a commercial award, so they do need to do that. And I don't have an issue, I guess, with a Chinese company deciding to sponsor the awards and then in return getting a Best Chinese Game category. That's fine by me.
Yeah, as a Chinese person, I am definitely going to be bothered by the inevitable jokes by everyone else at this category, though. That's going to happen. Definitely going to happen.
Yeah. But anyway, to move over to our own awards at Digitally Downloaded, I did want to quickly preempt them because, yeah, we do start to unveil our winners in 2 weeks or thereabouts, starting from the 1st of December. So that's something to look forward to. And I can assure you our winners are going to be very different. The process for us deciding on the awards is basically the entire Digitally Downloaded team, and there's a lot of us these days, all kind of vote on various games. We've come up with a shortlist, and from there we've narrowed it down to the three kind of the bronze, silver and gold medal winners. And yes, we've got a very different shortlist. I think we all had a lot of difficulty actually narrowing it down beyond the 10 finalists that we had, because like we said earlier in the section, it's been a remarkable year in terms of the quality and quantity of good, you know, games from AAA right down to more indie stuff. And we've tried to reflect all of that in our awards. We've tried to reflect both the big budget stuff and also smaller stuff that was perhaps overlooked by a lot of people. And the way we vote on these things, we consider them all to be of equal value. So we don't have we have an art house section, but we don't have an independent game section, or we don't have a Games for Impact Nonsense Award. Okay, so anyway, that's enough ranting about Game Awards. Look forward to ours. We look forward to hearing what you have to say about what we've ended up with. We'll go to a bit more music and then we'll talk about something a little bit different. This track is from Caligula Effect, a PlayStation Vita game which has a really remarkably good soundtrack. And this week it was announced there's going to be a PlayStation 4 remaster of the game, which is great for everybody who doesn't have a Vita. It's going to be a good chance to catch a JRPG that was very much overlooked and I think is one of the highlights of the year, actually. So enjoy the track and we'll be back soon. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that music. Told you it was good stuff. So for the second section of the podcast, we're going to talk about The Sims. The reason we're talking about The Sims is because I'm currently very addicted to them, thanks to the PlayStation 4 release of the game. Finally, I can't believe it's taken that long for EA to actually put out a console version of this game because it's not exactly pushing the PlayStation 4 hardware. I'm just surprised it took so long. But I guess with all the nonsense around Battlefront, it's good that EA had a win and actually released a good game this week as well. Yeah. I don't think anybody's going to say that's controversial. No one likes Battlefront. Terrible game. But Sims is good. Sims is really good. Plays really well on the PlayStation 4. And I think the thing that I love most about The Sims is the way that you kind of create your own stories with your characters as you're playing. EA provides the game provides the kind of the basic mechanics to have an environment to play the game in, But the real thrill of The Sims, or the real appeal of The Sims, is to create your little people and then torture them horribly by doing horrible things to them, or trying to make them survive if you want to play it nice. But nobody does that. Anyway, so my story, or my little Sim, had a pretty horrible time of it. I created the story. She kind of came to the town to start her, or to get her music career going, and she had all these great aspirations. But then the realities of life caught up with her, and she had to get a job, and she was too tired to actually practice her music, and her career kind of, you know, her dreams were crushed there and then. And yeah, that's pretty true to real life, I guess. So congratulations to EA for perfectly capturing that experience. I remember as a kid wanting to be a filmmaker, so I feel like I'm a Sim sometimes when I'm watching what happens to my characters. But yeah, everybody who plays The Sims kind of has their own way of playing and has their own stories that they like to create, and we get all kinds of crazy stuff and out of it as a result. I know both of you guys have played The Sims in the past, so what kind of horrible things do you subject your Sims to as you play?
So I play in a completely different way. I usually build the house first, use the money cheats, get to that point, and have like a huge mansion before I go and start torturing my Sims. Once I've got a house, it's usually partying and pizza, all the usual fun bachelor sort of stuff my Sim gets into. And then slowly they start to die. Maybe a few pools lose their, you know, ladders, or some doors disappear in a room full of furniture. You know, once you get sick of a Sim because they're just not performing the way they should be, or their career completely bottoms out, usually that what happens. Or maybe they're just flunking school. But at the end of the day, you need to get rid of Sims to make more Sims. There's only a six Sim limit, or an 8 Sim limit, depending on the game. And, you know, you need to have enough to be flexible and have all your Sims in the one house.
Nice. Yes. I'm glad that in real world, ladders don't disappear from pools, I must say. There is that theory going around in philosophy circles that the real world, or what we perceive as the real world, is just a simulation in itself. It's a good theory. It's actually fascinating reading if you ever want to delve down that particular rabbit hole. But I'm glad if that's true and we are all living in a simulation, I'm glad that whoever's watching us isn't pulling ladders away from our pools as we use them.
They're nice. The ladders are just a metaphor for the life's troubles and tribunals you run into. when you start running into issues, it's because the ladder physically got pulled apart, and you know, now you're back at the bottom again.
I love how we've just gotten two very different existential views on The Sims. We've gotten Matt's reality is the worst and your dreams will get crushed, and then we've had Trent's your ladder will disappear and you'll be stuck in a pool forever. It's both very like thought-provoking A-plus podcast material this week.
Yeah, but that's what's great about The Sims, isn't it? Because you can play it however you want, you can, you know, project whatever you want onto your little people. And yeah, if you want the cold realities of the real world to be part of your Sim experience, you can do that. I must admit, it does, you know, get, I want to say, grindy when through the weekday your character has to pull herself off over to, you know, to two different jobs each day, and that's basically all she does. And then you get a little bit of fun on the weekend before it starts again. I mean, that's very much like real life. So it's weird that it's compelling enough that I keep playing for weeks and weeks and weeks and end. But that's the magic of it, I guess.
That's why you use some money cheats and then make them party.
There are no cheats in real life, Trent. There are no cheats.
Yeah, in real life, that's called being born into a good family.
Yeah.
Unless you get deleted and die in the pool fire.
All right, what about you, Harvard? When you play The Sims, what's your Sim story?
Or I'm really different. I feel like I'm more like the the nice player. I don't do things to like outwardly kill the Sims, and I just like I try to get them their promotions and get them the nice house and just watch them be happy and like make friends with each other. And I think from there you get different stories out of here. You guys sound like so bored right now. Must be like so just like this is not how you play Sims. But yeah, I like when naturally nice stories appear. I like when like neighbors suddenly become friends with each other just out of nowhere, and then like some weird event will happen and then they suddenly hate each other. It's just, I like how if you leave the game alone, it starts to, I guess, incubate its own narratives, which I don't think a lot of other games are set up to do. And so in a way, it's almost interesting just to sit back and watch what will happen if you just chuck all the personalities together and like create an environment for this interaction.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that they will do whatever they feel like they need to do next if you leave it alone. It's not something I do because I do micromanage my sim to the like minute. You know, it's like, so it's, you know, 7:32 in the morning. Okay, you're going to go to the bathroom now. That's kind of the level of control I enact over my sim, mostly because she's so bloody busy. She hasn't got time to, you know, stand around and do nothing. But yeah, it's good that, again, this is the great thing about The Sims and the way that EA has pulled it together over the years, that it is so open in terms of how you approach the game. That you can go kind of just leave them there and they'll go and do their own thing and get themselves into trouble. And that's cool as well. Especially if you're going to have a big family, like, I always generally play, or I generally play as a single sim, but Sims 4 especially allows you to create entire families with toddlers through to grandparents. And I can imagine if I had, you know, 5 or 6 different people running around, I wouldn't want to be micromanaging every single minute of every single one of their lives, because I just wouldn't get any further in the game. So I could leave the toddler alone to get itself stuck in the pool, and that'd be okay.
See, what I usually do is if one's at work, then I micromanage, say, the wife or, like, the child I'm trying to groom into, like, you know, a musician or, like, you know, a bookworm or a computer nerd or something, so they can go off to do those sort of skills. Or if someone's at work or doing something, there's usually the other sim which you can play around with and get them to do things if they're not busy as well.
Yeah, of course. When you only play as one sim, when they're off at work, the game just goes super speed until they get home from work. But if you've got more than one sim and they're not all at work at the same time, the time in the game would continue to progress normally, and you just go and, you know, focus on whatever that one sim who's not at work is doing. I don't know if there are that many people who haven't played sim games by now out there. I think it's one of those kind of universal franchises that everybody's at least a little bit familiar with. I actually hadn't played The Sims 3, and the one before that I'd played was the DS one, which was not a great game. So Sims 4 is actually quite far advanced. The additions and the changes that have been made to the game over the years has been quite impressive, because I really like where things are at with Sims 4 now.
As someone who played all the Sims, the Sims 2, the Sims 3 and the Sims 4, the Sims 4 is like the Sim City version of the Sims 4. Like, it's that modern, let's do everything fancy, you know, let's cut some corners here, oh, but you're focusing over here now, you should have a family, you should have a house, like, in this small little block. That it's that sort of experience. Like, I don't think the Sims 4, I haven't played it for quite some time, but the Sims 4, especially at launch, was never that complete package. It was a very broken game, because it, compared to the past iterations of the Sims, it just seems less complete.
And that might be why they've waited until now to actually release the thing on consoles. Because, what I'm playing doesn't quite match up with what you're saying there, Trent. So it feels a much more complete game anyway to me. So it might be that they've added to it or they've continued to work on it. Because obviously they do, because they release so many expansions for the game as well. So there'd be all kinds of patches and enhancements made since that original launch. And that might be why it's taken so long for it to come out to console. EA might have been waiting for it to be at a state that made it worthwhile doing a single release to console. Who knows? Who knows what EA is thinking these days? Because, yeah, again, Battlefield 2.
Does it have loot boxes, Matt?
There's no loot boxes, so thank goodness. That came slightly before loot boxes. There's all kinds of DLC, because that was the rage back in those days when Sims 4 first came out, but no loot boxes. You can expect those to come.
Packs.
Sims 5 will have loot boxes. So many loot boxes. Everything will be a loot box.
Your house is a loot box.
Yeah, your house is a loot box.
Your Sims go to work, come back from work, get a promotion.
it's like a mobile game where it pops up with like the lottery sort of stuff. It's like click here to like get a loot, open a loot box because your Sims leveled up and got an achievement.
Speaking of mobile games, there is the Sims mobile game. I don't know if any either of you even played that at all. My wife actually really likes that one. She plays it a little bit, or quite a bit, and has over quite a period of time now. So obviously it's slightly different. I didn't realize that one's actually, the content for that game is actually managed by Fire Monkeys, which is an Australian developer. So yeah, all that Sims stuff on the Sims mobile game is actually Australian developed now, which is pretty cool. But yeah, I think that's a good summary, I guess, of the Sims. I guess the reason, like I said, at the start, we wanted to talk about it was mostly because it came out this week and it's been a bit of an addiction for me. So yeah, if you got a PlayStation 4, check it out. I think it's worth looking at. Certainly get it instead of Battlefront 2. Don't get Battlefront 2. Terrible game. So we're going to have a bit of music against another release this week. Skyrim came out on the Nintendo Switch and PlayStation VR, so lots of Skyrim out there again. And the music's really good from it, so we figured we'd play a track from Skyrim. So enjoy, and we'll come back and talk a bit more. Welcome back, everybody. For the last section of the podcast, we are going to talk about super artsy games, because, yeah, we do like our indie titles, but on top of that, we like our indie titles that do all kinds of weird stuff. They are generally or often discredited as not being games at all because, you know, walking simulators or not interactive enough, or just generally you don't kill something and therefore a lot of people don't like it. But yeah, there's been quite a few of them that have come out in recent weeks on every platform. So we thought we'd talk about a couple of our highlights. I know, Harvard, you've been playing one on the Switch that you really like and want to encourage everyone to play, so let us know about it.
Yeah, definitely. So this is a game called Wheels of Aurelia, which came out on the Switch, I think, last week. It's actually been out on Steam since forever, but it's not really been on my radar until now. And it's kind of like a road trip simulator set in 1970s Italy with two women who talk about social issues and, like, types of government and meeting road hitchhikers and people in different cities and just traveling on the countryside. I know it doesn't sound like the most riveting kind of game, but when you start playing it and just get into that vibe, it's just really interesting. Like, just to hear the way that the characters see the world based on their culture, and to hear the Italian rock and the car stereo, and just to see the way that developers have taken real cities and made them into this really palatable, low-poly graphical style, I think it all just comes together really nicely.
So you'd say, I mean, obviously this is a narrative-focused game. What would you kind of, is it kind of a deep game, or is it more entertaining? Is it lighthearted? Is it kind of, you know, hard and heavy stuff? How would you characterize the storytelling?
I think it's not like an intellectually deep game. Like, you don't need to probe super deep into the narrative to get it, but it does touch on some really pertinent social issues, and it uses that historical period to then make more of a comment on how we see society today. And I think the conversation just flows very naturally. You get a really good sense of who the characters are. And the game, like, a playthrough only lasts for about 15 minutes, and there's 16 endings. It's not a long game by any means, but you feel very in touch with the way that the characters think and feel, and I think that's a really good takeaway from it.
In terms of the different endings, is that because it's like a visual novel where you make different dialogue choices? Is that how the narrative
goes? Yeah, kind of like that. So it's funny because you have to drive your car, which you can do automatically, or you can do it faster by driving manually. And you need to be juggling what thing you're going to say to the person you're driving with on the other side. And so it's kind of this weird balancing act of, like, don't hit the other cars, but also figure out what to say. It's nothing like anything I've tried before.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of why we like to play these games, because they are fundamentally different. They're not, certainly don't fit into the standard view on how to make a game, that's for sure. The one I wanted to mention just came out this week on the PlayStation 4. I don't know if it's on other platforms, I assume it is. This one is called Far From Noise. And it's really kind of fascinating. Again, it's a very narrative-driven game. Basically, you play as a woman who wakes up to find out that her car, she obviously was in some kind of accident, her car is teetering on the edge of a cliff. She can't actually get out, so she's stuck there, rocking back and forth, just, I guess, waiting for the car to go over the edge finally. And then she starts to have a conversation with a deer that shows up. It's kind of, I guess, assumed that she's hallucinating in some way. But yeah, she has this quite deep and existentialist conversation with a deer. And basically what you're doing is selecting different bits of dialogue for her or different responses for her based on what's going on. I don't think those decisions change how the game plays out. At least I haven't finished it yet. But it seems to be quite arbitrary in terms of the decisions that you make. So again, it's a very narrative-driven game. And you're basically sitting there just watching the sunset and sun come up again and waiting as well, along with the girl, for the car, which seems pretty inevitable, to go over the edge. It's got a very strong kind of absurdist feel to it, as somebody who really got into Absurdist Theatre back when I was at university, and was a big fan of Waiting for Godot and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead and various other kind of highlights of that particular philosophy and academic genre. The game has a really strong sense of that to it, which I find really appealing. And again, it's like you said, with Wheels of Aurelia, Harvard, it's just something I haven't actually experienced before. So I'm really enjoying it and would recommend everybody check it out. It's only $15 or whatever on PS4. So worth the money as far as I'm concerned. Trent, have you played any of these kind of like super ultra artsy games recently?
See, I'm in a kind of weird, awkward position where the last indie game I played was Golf Story on the Switch. so sort of playing the indie games as they get really popular on the internet. It's like, everyone, you must play this game. I'm like, okay, Golf Story is it. So everyone knows how Golf Story went. But with indie games, I think the big issue is a lot of them, you know, we play as they come out. We're like, okay, well, this is the big game. This is the big indie game at the moment. You know, this is what we've found, I'm going to play that. But, you know, if I remember from a few years ago, the most, like in the past recent years, the most recent indie games which fit what we've been discussing and are very profound games were Beyond Eyes and That Dragon Cancer, I found were, you know, quite good games which sort of have, indie games sort of just disappear. And, you know, I'd recommend for people to pick up both of those games. Beyond Eyes was a very interesting game. I think it appeared on both the PC and the Xbox. Basically, it was you'd play as a blind girl and you would navigate the world, and the world would be basically white. You wouldn't be able to see anything but the only like a foot or so in front of you, which would be sort of coloured. And as sound sort of happens around the world, you would see in the distance, like if a bird chirps, you'd see this colour sort of appear around the bird. And it was a very interesting mechanic to sort of portray that blindness to visual seeing people. And the story in general is just, you know, it's a walking simulator sort of, but it's a deeply profound story of about this blind girl who's, you know, lost looking for a cat. And it shows her looking through all these towns and, you know, before going back to a cottage and, yeah, just looking for a pet cat. But it's got a very unique story. It's got a very unique appearance to it. And it's something which has probably been forgotten over the years game-wise. And the other one, That Dragon Cancer, was the game developer had a dying child and basically made this game. And it's a very deeply personal story for that developer. And it's, you know, very interesting how that's conveyed in a game. It's not a very gamey game. Like, it's the only point in the game where you're actually playing physically, like something which makes you feel like it's obvious as a video game, is there's this like Mario Kart version in like the hospital. So you get on like a little trolley as a kid and drive around the hospital halls like a Mario Kart race. That's the only point in the whole game where it's like it's a video game. Like, is, but the story is basically at that point where you're like, okay, this has to happen. Like, it's not, because of how the child's disease is progressing at that point, it's sort of like, it's a sort of like a distraction to the story itself. So it's a deeply personal love message, and I think that that's those both those games are games which should be picked up and played, you know, which are long forgotten because they obviously came out last year, and I think That Dragon Cancer came out the year before. But indie games should be something which we look back, even the older ones. So
yeah, I mean, there are some that kind of stick around in people's memory, at least in terms of this particular category, when people start to talk about these kinds of games, like you mentioned, those ones pop up in people's minds. I think the mobile platform is another really good place for a lot of this stuff. And you see a lot of developers creating some interesting stuff and releasing it on mobile. There's one that I'm just about to start playing. I had it downloaded for a while. I haven't got around to it, but hopefully I'll find some time this weekend. It's called Bury Me, My Love, which is a...
It's a Games for Impact.
It's a Games for Impact, yes.
Is that the one which is just basically text messages?
Yeah, it is. It's the one about the Syrian refugee who's communicating with text messages.
Yeah, that's right. It's the story about a Syrian refugee who's trying to get out of, I guess, Syria, and the experiences that they go through, and it's told via text message back to their loved one, who I believe is still in Syria. So I think that's the basis of it, and obviously very poignant given the world today. And I'm looking forward to, I guess, getting into that one and seeing it in more detail. I'm hoping it has the impact that it obviously promises. Another one that I think is worth looking into is, what's his name? Will O'Neill's games. So Actual Sunlight and Little Red Lie, his two games.
Oh, it's going to make another one.
Yeah, I haven't got around to reviewing it. I've had it sitting there for a long time now. It's called Little Red Lie. And he basically takes RPG Maker and then turns them into some pretty emotionally brutal games that deal with very kind of dark places that people get into in real life. Actual Sunlight has been around for a long time now. Everyone knows that's about suicide. Little Red Lie is basically a damning criticism of the capitalism that people get stuck in, the capitalist systems, and the way that people can get exploited, and the way that people who come out on top, you know, live life. It's basically, you know, everything that happened to my poor Sim played out in a very real story. So, yeah, you need to be in a particular frame of mind for those games because they can be pretty crushing. And I don't recommend playing them if you're down yourself, but they are very potent and very important. And I guess that's, you know, ultimately what we come to for these kinds of games, these, you know, ultra artsy indie titles. It's not obviously not the gameplay and inverted commas that we play them for. It's for the messaging, and it's for the impact that they have on us. And it's for, I guess, you know, we want to relate to them in some way. And it's good to know that there are developers out there telling those kinds of stories through games, because previously, obviously, you'd have to watch a very low-budget film or read a very low-production-run book to get the kind of stories that these games are telling. And yeah. So, to wrap things up for music this week, we've actually going to use a track from Wheels of Aurelia, because, like Harvard said, it's got really good music. And if this doesn't convince you to at least have a look at the game, nothing will. Enjoy, and thanks for listening, and we look forward to catching you next week for the podcast. Thanks, everyone.